I want to say that we're in lesson 11 this morning, but we're going to finish lesson 10. Lesson 10, of course, is a discussion of Elihu's speeches, three speeches and kind of a conclusion or a fourth speech. And on Wednesday, we got through lesson 11, or 10 rather, through the first four questions, I believe. And so I'd like to quickly look at some of the other questions, and then we'll move on to God's first challenge to Job. God has two speeches, extended speeches, and we'll look at the brief replies that that Job makes. I think it's a sermon thing. Talking about Paul in the sermon, just can't get away from him. I'm sorry? You know, I just really hate it when people use things against me. Yeah, it's a habit. It's a habit. So here's question five in lesson 10. With what sin did Elihu charge Job in the end of his second speech? And I gave you a couple of verses there, verses 36 and 37 of chapter 34. Was he right? Had Job actually sinned in this way? So I'm going to, as I've been doing, kind of just launch into an answer here and then open the floor afterwards. So listen to 36 and 37 of chapter 34 in the ESV. Would that Job were tried to the end, because he answers like wicked men. For he adds rebellion to his sin. He claps his hands among us and multiplies his words against God. And so Elihu says, he's speaking like wicked men, he's added rebellion to his sin. Gibson makes the note in his commentary on Job, clapping the hands at someone was a sign of derision. So he's clapping his hands among us against the friends. Some things here that Elihu also said. Verse 31 and 32 of chapter 34. For has anyone said to God, I have borne punishment, I will not offend anymore. Teach me what I do not see. If I've done iniquity, I will do it no more. Job's words, I think, had been rash. You think Job spoke like wicked men? Is Elihu justified in making that charge? Has Job added rebellion to his sin? What do you think? I see some no's. Yeah, I think that's an unfair characterization of Job. However, as I'm going to show you on successive slides here, he said some rash things. For instance, and we looked at some of these, obviously, as we've studied through the dialogue between Job and his friends. Look at chapter 7, verse 17 through 20. What is man that you make so much of him, God says, or Job says to God, and that you set your heart on him? Visit him every morning and test him every moment. How long will you not look away from me, nor leave me alone till I swallow my spit? If I sin, what do I do to you, you watcher of mankind? Why have you made me your mark? Why have I become a burden to you? He's asking some questions. Why are you doing this to me? Look at chapter 9, verses 21 through 24. We've read this several times. He talks about God covering the faces of the judges, and that's response. That's the reason that wickedness seems to reign on the earth. It's God who's doing this. If it's not He, who then is it? He says at the end of verse 24. Chapter 10, verse 16. And were my head lifted up, you would hunt me like a lion and again work wonders against me. You renew your witnesses against me and increase your vexation toward me. You bring fresh troops against me. Of course, that's not a revelation that Job was blaming God, or at least thought God was responsible for what's been happening to him. Continuing on in chapter 13, will you frighten a driven leaf and pursue dry chaff? For you write bitter things against me and make me inherit the iniquities of my youth. You put my feet in the stocks and watch all my paths. You set a limit for the soles of my feet. Now that's Job talking to God. That's what he says. Chapter 16, God gives me up to the ungodly and casts me into the hands of the wicked. I was at ease and he broke me apart. He seized me by the neck and dash me to pieces. He set me up as his target. His archers surround me. He slashes open my kidneys and does not spare. He pours out my gall on the ground. He breaks me with breach upon breach. He runs upon me like a warrior. What do you think about some of those things? Pretty rash. He's pretty descriptive, pretty vivid in what he thinks God's doing to him. You think Job is alone in that? Or do you know of any other passages or places in Scripture where someone spoke their heart's thoughts? How about in some of the lamentations of Psalms, in the Psalms, where the writer has some pretty vivid things to say about what's happening to him and why, God, are you not doing anything about this? Continuing, in Job 19, know then that God has put me in the wrong and closed his net about me. Behold, I cry out violence, but I'm not answered. I call for help, but there's no justice. He's walled up my way so that I cannot pass, and he's set darkness upon my paths. He's stripped me from me my glory and taken the crown from my head. He breaks me down on every side, and I am gone, and my hope has he pulled up like a tree. He has kindled his wrath against me and counts me as his adversary. His troops come on together. They have cast up their siege ramp against me and encamp around my tent. He definitely is saying, God's doing all this to me. I'm not sure I would characterize that as rebellion. In fact, we need to look at the next question. What complaint of Job did Elihu quote in 35:3? 35:3. What advantage, Elihu says in verse 2, do you think this to be just? Do you say it is my right before God that you ask, what advantage have I? How am I better off than if I had sinned? What good does it do to be righteous? That's what Elihu says that Job is thinking or saying. It doesn't make any difference if I'm righteous or wicked. So might as well be wicked. Well, we need to look at some differences in translation here. If you look at the ESV, I just read it. Now compare the New King James Version. It's the second scripture up there. Do you think this is right? Do you say my righteousness is more than God's? For you say, what advantage will it be to you? What profit shall I have more than if I had sinned? Job speaking to God. Well, what would be the advantage if I'm righteous more than if I just, you know, sin like everybody else? I don't know. I kind of wonder if the New King James Version doesn't have the better translation here. I understand that in Hebrew some things are not as exact as, say, for instance, in English or Greek or some other languages. And so that's the reason sometimes you get some very different translations, meanings in verses. But I think Job 35, 2 and 3 in the New King James Version fits pretty well. Job has proclaimed his righteousness and he's challenged God's justice, hasn't he? We just read passages. God did this to me. Now Elihu is quoting Job as saying that there's no profit in being righteous. Job say that? Well, take a look at chapter 21, verses 15, 16, again at the bottom of the slide there. What is the Almighty that we should serve Him? And what profit do we get if we pray to Him? That kind of sounds like somebody saying it doesn't make any difference if you're righteous or wicked. Context. Because that's not what Job is saying. Job is quoting the wicked. He's saying that's what the wicked say. They say that it doesn't make any difference. God can't know. What can He do to us? Behold, is not their prosperity in their hand? The counsel of the wicked is far from me. Job specifically says, I don't believe that. Well, here's what he says, though, in chapter 9, verses 28 through 31. I become afraid of all my suffering, for I know you will not hold me innocent. I shall be condemned. Why then do I labor in vain? If I wash myself with snow and cleanse my hands with lye, yet you will plunge me into a pit and my own clothes will abhor me. Is Job saying that there's no profit in being righteous here? I think there's another way to understand this. Yeah, David?
I think he's saying that there's no way for me to be completely righteous in God's eyes.
Okay. So possibility that he's saying there's no way he can be perfectly righteous in God's eyes. Anybody else? Want to comment on this? Is Job talking about man's behavior in general, or is he talking about this business of standing before God and making his case? I think that's a possibility. Job said some rash things, but Job never followed the advice of his wife, which was curse God and die. Curse God means basically say goodbye to God. He's obviously causing you to suffer. Job's wife probably believed the same thing as Job and his three friends. He's obviously very displeased with you. You're suffering so horribly. Just go ahead and tell him goodbye and let him finish you off. God does not, or Job does not do that. And of course, that was the claim that Satan made. You know, you touch his stuff and he'll curse you to your face. Oh, well, you didn't touch him. Now touch him, chapter 2, and he'll curse you to your face. And Job didn't do that. Although he speaks out of his despair, he speaks in his suffering. He's doesn't understand why all this is happening to him. And so he says some things that I think are rash. All right, comments or questions, anybody, before we move on? I'm going to try to move through this quickly. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, if it's all right. Take a look at the next question here, number 7. What did Elihu think was the reason that God did not relieve the suffering of some men despite their cries? Now, Elihu talks about that. You hear people crying out to God. Why does God not take care of their suffering, relieve them of their suffering? Well, here's Elihu's answer. He argues that they're crying out because of their suffering, but they're not recognizing the sovereignty or the wisdom of God. And so their cries are empty, so to speak. Look at chapter 35, verse 9. Because of the multitude of oppressions, people cry out. They call for help because of the arm of the mighty. But none says, where is God my maker, who gives songs in the night, who teaches us more than the beasts of the earth and makes us wiser than the birds of the heavens? There they cry out, but he does not answer, because of the pride of evil men. Surely God does not hear an empty cry, nor does the Almighty regard it. You think Elihu's talking about Job? You think he thinks Job is the reason God hasn't, you know, stopped the suffering of Job is because Job is not acknowledging God as his maker and talking about God's good works, the good things that God has done? I think it's possible. It wouldn't be unlike the friends, would it? That gets to your comment, Phil, to me before class, that sometimes when people are suffering, what they need to do is think about the things that God has done for them instead of questioning whether God still loves them. I think I summarized that rather briefly, but that was the general idea. Surely God does not hear an empty cry. Where is God my maker, who gives songs in the night, who teaches us, makes us wiser than the birds of the heaven? They cry out. He doesn't answer. Why? Because it's empty. All they want, it's the foxhole bargain with God. I'm in danger. I'm suffering. God, help me, please. So if God takes away the suffering, what happens? Nothing. They didn't change. They were bargaining with God just to relieve their suffering. That's an empty cry. And Elihu, I suspect, may be applying that to Job. Comments or questions, anybody? All right. So, another question here. The last one we're going to look at. Discuss Elihu's answer to Job's suffering as compared to the doctrine of the friends. This is a little bit of a difficult question. Is his explanation any different than the friends? Is Elihu, in your opinion, any closer to the truth? Well, I guess I've got two questions in here and a discussion, so this may take a little while. Do you think his view of suffering is any different than the friends? I see. I'm sorry?
Not much.
Okay. And I see some other no's. I hate to be tedious, but the friends believe suffering is the result of personal sin and in proportion to that sin. The more you sin, the greater your sin, the more you're suffering. Okay? Is Elihu saying the same thing? Well, I suspect that Elihu probably believes the same thing, but I will tell you, I think his focus is different than the friends. Here's what I mean by that. What are the friends focused on? I'm sorry, say again. Okay, the sins of Job when? When? Prior to his suffering. His sins caused this suffering. But I think Elihu focuses on what Job has done while he's suffering. He speaks like wicked men. He adds rebellion. He says, oh, it doesn't do any good to be righteous. He's accusing Job of these things. But he's talking about while Job is suffering, I believe. There's an interesting quotation here. I'm sharing with you here from, it's actually in Wayne Jackson's commentary, but he's quoting another individual by the name of Roy Zuck. I don't recognize his name. He says, whereas Elihu's three elders, the friends, had recommended that Job repent of willful sin committed prior to his calamities, Elihu recommended that, number one, that Job repent of pride that developed because of his suffering, and two, that Job exalt God's work, talked about that just a moment, consider his works and fear him. The three counselors had claimed that Job was suffering because he was sinning. Elihu explained that he was sinning because he was suffering. His suffering led to an attitude of pride before God and a questioning of God's ways. I think that's accurate. I think that's truthful. The triad's diagnosis pertained to sinful actions in Job's past experience, whereas Elihu's diagnosis dealt with sinful attitudes in Job's present life. That is, during the time that he's suffering and this the dialogue of the book. I mentioned in the quotation here, there's some verses mentioned. Here they are, 36:24. Remember to extol his work of which men have sung. You need to be extolling the work of God, not criticizing his justice. 37:14. Hear this, O Job. Stop and consider the wondrous works of God. Chapter 37:24, therefore men fear him. He does not regard any who are wise in their own conceit. And so the friend's view is that suffering is God's punishment of sinners. They hold out hope of repentance. Elihu also would encourage Job to repent of his behavior during his suffering, the rash things that he has said in the dialogue with his friends. Ralph and then David. Yes, that's correct. And I think, that's why I think Zuck's comment is correct. Because God doesn't, he doesn't even acknowledge Elihu. But he does criticize the three friends. And so there's some difference between them. We discussed in the last class that Elihu says that God causes men to suffer for a couple of reasons in order to discipline them, actually to save them, not to punish them. The friends think this is punishment. But not to punish men, but to bring them back from the pit. Men who are sinful, let's not lionize Elihu too much. But he believes that God speaks to them in dreams or visions and that God gives them pain. Pain is a wonderful thing for getting your attention. And Elihu says, sometimes God gets men's attention that way. David, your comment. Oh, okay. I think the idea of regard here is acceptance. There's nothing said about Elihu one way or the other, accepted or rejected. The friends are criticized. Elihu is just ignored, I guess. Do you think it's just the idea he didn't mention him or that he doesn't accept him?
It's possible that it's because he's wise in his own eyes. I mean, that's pretty much what he would say.
Yeah. In chapter 32, he certainly comes across as believing in his own wisdom. Yeah. Well, that's interesting. I don't know if everybody heard that. I'm not going to try to repeat all that, but that's another possible way of looking at that passage that Elihu may inadvertently be talking about himself. All right. Other comments or questions? Are we done with Elihu? All right. Let's get to the whirlwind. Go to chapter 38. Chapter 38 in Job. Verse 1. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said. You know, growing up in Illinois, I lived in central Illinois essentially all of my youth. And the fields there are flat. You couldn't find a hill to save your life. And the farmers have cut down most of the trees. So you could look at the horizon. And I know growing up, we would look across the fields and you could see a whirlwind. You could see a tornado way across the fields. We didn't worry about it. It was way over there. It wasn't anywhere near us. And so I didn't worry about whirlwinds until 2011. When one passed about an eighth of a mile from my house. And I thought, as I heard the house creak, this is it. Debbie and I were crouched in the master bathroom. This is where the Lord takes us. It didn't happen. But I'll tell you what, ever since then, I've got a much healthier respect for tornadoes, whirlwinds, the power of that wind. God comes to Job, not in a cloud. This is my beloved son in whom I'm well pleased. Not in a dream. He comes in something that frankly represents power. He speaks to Job out of the whirlwind. Do you think that's by accident? I don't. When you understand the purpose of God's speech, you know that this was no accident. Because he's going to make a point with Job in the successive verses of his speech. So, today, we're down here close to the end of the book. We'll be looking at God's first speech. And, of course, Job's response there at the end of 39, beginning of 40. Be able to describe the character and purpose of God's speech. I think that's important to the whole idea of the book. Because this book, I don't think, technically is about human suffering primarily. It's about faith. It's about people staying loyal to God even when they don't understand what God is doing. Job didn't understand why he's suffering. But God doesn't let him off the hook and say, well, you know, Job, it's okay what you said, because you just didn't know. As good as Job was, his faith could be tested and needed to be strengthened. And I think that's what this book is about. We'll look at the effect on Job of God's speech. We'll see here in chapter 40, the beginning, Job's response. So the first question I ask you, in what two broad areas did God question Job's knowledge and power? Here's my answer to that. He questions Job's knowledge about both the inanimate part of this creation and also animate nature. I want you to listen to the beginning here in verse 2 of chapter 38. God says, "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge?" Is he talking about the friends? No. He's talking to Job. "Dress for action like a man. I will question you and you make it known to me." And now Job gets his chance. God asks him question after question after question. Job doesn't know the answers. He wanted to have a conversation with God. Actually, what he wanted to do was call God down and make God answer why this is happening to him. He needed an explanation. Where's my iniquity? You know, why are you doing this to me? But when God finally does meet with Job in this conversation, Job doesn't have too much to say. And so, just some examples. not a conclusive. We're not going to read the whole speech. We don't really have time. But chapter 38, verses 4 and 5. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? Do you think God's being sarcastic here? I do. Surely you know, Job. What's God saying? Well, first of all, he's implying Job doesn't know, right? I mean, that's obvious. Job doesn't know these things. Has Job come across as thinking that he knows what's going on? I'm suffering, God's doing this to me. Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? I'm going to question you. You make it known to me. Let's start with creation. Well, you know, don't you, Job? You were there, right? Chapter 38, verse 18. Have you comprehended the expanse of the earth? Declare if you know all this. Where is the way to the dwelling of light, and where is the place of darkness? That you may take it to its territory, and that you may discern the paths to its home. You know, for you were born then, and the number of your days is great. Oh yeah, that's sarcasm. That's sarcasm. What's he doing? What's he trying to do? God. Yeah, David? That's exactly the phrase I was thinking of. Put him in his place. Go ahead.
Making him understand that he is not the same as God and does not understand.
Exactly. You are not able to know all the... You don't know all this stuff. I did these things. You don't know anything about this. So he puts Job in his place. That's just a couple of examples. The whole speech is questions about, do you know this, Job? Do you know that? What do you know about this creature or this feature of the physical world? And of course, what's Job going to say? Well, he doesn't know. So look at question two. Contrast Job's confrontation with God with that debate that Job had desired. I think in Job's mind, he was going to stand before God and he was going to ask questions and God was going to answer him. But that got turned around, didn't it? He's standing before God, and God's asking the questions, and he wants Job to answer, and Job doesn't know. I like the expression, God's putting Job in his place. He's telling Job, you are not capable of understanding even the physical world like I do as the Creator. And I think then the implication is, how are you going to understand how I work in the moral matters of this world? Because that's what Job has been questioning, right? Why is God doing all this? Seems unfair. God's not treating me right. I saw Kathy's hand. Who else? Seems like there was somebody else. I know I saw Jennifer's hand, but I was ignoring her. Anybody else? Anybody else, please? All right. Kathy, Jennifer, Ralph, and Daniel. Go ahead, Kathy. At least at times, at some point, and I don't recall the chapter, I apologize, I think it's chapter 9, 15 or something like that. He talks about a mediator. I need a mediator. I need someone who will stand between us. And that I think is, did I click that already? I guess. That kind of acknowledges that he's not on the same level with God. But in other places, I'll stand before him and make my case. Jennifer? Right.
Isn't some of it observable? And the point is, maybe Job could know this, but he still doesn't. You know, the foundations of the earth, there's no way for Job to know that. The spiritual realm, there's no way. But I felt like some of it, I mean, we know it today, and I wondered if God's point was, you could have learned this, but you wouldn't even know this. My observation and experience.
I think that's a fair observation, that Job could have known some things about the world around him, the animate nature at least, the kingdom of animals and birds, etc. God's speech may be shading into, I'm the one who runs things here. Not just do you know, but you know how this works. He mentions a couple of animals. Oh, I'm going to show my ignorance here. When he gets into talking about animate nature, down in chapter 39, verse 1, do you know when the mountain goats give birth? Do you observe the calving of the does? Can you number the months that they fulfill? And do you know the time when they give birth? When they crouch, bring forth their offspring, and are delivered of their young. Commentators note that these are animals who typically, when they give birth to young, they go off into kind of a place that's hidden. And so the intimation is, do you know these things that are kind of more secret as opposed to the things that you could just look and see and you know? So there may be some of both of these ideas. You know, Job, you could know this. I know it, and I'm the one who sustains all of these creatures. But then there's other things that Job can't possibly know. So there's maybe both of those things. Ralph, you're next, and then Daniel.
Job would have received spiritual benefit from his experience and God's blessings, but those that have proceeded for millennia after Job, that's the wisdom of God, because he has given us something that we can learn for.
Sure.
Sure.
Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah, Daniel?
Well, I was talking about the other thing, to think that Job was trying to bring God down to man's level, spiritual level, what man's sin level is.
Yeah.
Listening to God and now trying to bring Job down to his level.
Or show him that he's not at his level. Yeah, that's an interesting observation, that Job has been trying to bring God down to his level as though they can have this conversation. He'll make God explain, or call God on the carpet, so to speak, to explain why this is happening. And now God is showing Job that he's not at God's level. So interesting, yeah. Eric? Yeah.
They're speaking these things with so much confidence that they have this knowledge and they have this wisdom. And let me tell you about this and that. And in the end, you know, God really sets all of them in their place. Of course, here he's, you know, he's setting Job in his place.
Right.
But it's this worldly wisdom that we think we have that really doesn't match up.
But the good thing is that modern man doesn't suffer from that defect, because we're all humble and we acknowledge that God is so much greater than we are, and that he knows, and that we don't understand, we don't have the wisdom that God has, right? Or do you think modern man does the same thing that Job and his friends were doing, assuming that they know things that they didn't know? Yeah, Phil? Right.
What God says. You know,
right.
We get in these positions where, when we're by ourselves or in a group of people that we think are on the same lines, we get the bravado. We're really bold. But then when we get in terms of the person who may have the authority, or even not just God, but even with men, other men, we'll be a lot of times do exactly what Job did, and we will. We just kind of we lose that willingness to stand up and be brave and bold, because we realize that we're wrong.
Yeah. I'm not taking anything away from your comment, because I acknowledge that that's certainly true. But I'm thinking about Job. Here's the whirlwind, okay? And God speaks to him out of this whirlwind and says, Job, I got some questions for you. How many of us would stand before God and say, well, here's what I've been wanting to tell you. This is the reason I want... Or would we do exactly like Job and clam up because we recognize after a few questions that we don't know any of the answers? We'd want the mountains to fall on us. That's exactly right. So I don't want to be too hard on Job, although men tend to be more arrogant and say their wisdom if they're not challenged. Chapter 9, verses 14, 15. How then can I answer him, choosing my words with him? Though I am in the right, I cannot answer him. I must appeal for mercy to my accuser. Job has even acknowledged it. God's powerful. You can't turn him around. You can't call him back from something that he's done. He's God. So, you know, he's not always acting as though God's on the same level as he is. He says in 13:3, but I would speak to the Almighty and I desire to argue my case with God. That's what we've been saying all along. He wants to argue his case with God. When that thing was flashing, I thought maybe I was having a stroke. It was going on and off. Look at 13, verse 15. Though he slay me, I will hope in him, yet I will argue my ways to his face. This will be my salvation, that the godless shall not come before him. If I could come before God, then I could tell him about my ways, and I would argue my case, and he would listen. Keep listening to my words, and let my declaration be in your ears. Behold, I prepared my case. I know that I shall be in the right. Who is there who will contend with me? For then I would be silent and die. Only grant me these two things, then I will not hide myself from your face. Withdraw your hand far from me. He's talking to God. And let not dread of you terrify me. You know, God's hand is heavy on Job with all this suffering. Give me some relief. Don't terrify me. Then call and I will answer, or let me speak and you reply to me. How many are my iniquities and my sins? Make me know my transgression and my sin. Why do you hide your face and count me as an enemy, as your enemy? Does he want God to come down and answer him? Oh, yeah. Chapter 23. Oh, that I knew where I might find him, that I might come even to his seat. I would lay my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. I would know what he would answer me and understand what he would say to me. Would he contend with me in the greatness of his power? No, he would pay attention to me. There an upright man could argue with him, and I would be acquitted forever by my judge. You kind of got to admire Job from the standpoint that he thinks that if he gets a chance to talk to God, God's going to reverse all this. He's going to be found righteous. Of course, when the opportunity comes for him to, say, oh, wait a minute. I've got some questions for you. Job's silent. Yeah, Eric.
I hear a lot of David in Job. Some of the Psalms, you know, David talks about going after Saul's chasing after David, and David in despair. Why have you forsaken me? All of them. I see a lot of similar sentiments.
Yeah.
For what that's
worth. Yeah, and I think those are some of the laments in the Psalms that I mentioned earlier. I believe you're right. There's some of the same questioning. I think Job, ultimately, just like David, ultimately, is going to rely on God, even if he doesn't understand why God hasn't answered him already.
I guess that what tells me is it's okay for us, too, sometimes, to question and ask God, where are you when I'm suffering? And then not to, and then come ultimately to the same conclusion that Job and David said. I was there all the time. He just didn't know.
Yeah. I think sometimes people say things in the midst of emotional crises that reflect impatience or doubt, despair. You see that in some of the Psalms. I do, in some of David's Psalms, as you've noted. Artificial spirituality. Or I pretend that I don't feel that way. Yeah, I would agree with you. Let me just quickly move along here. 31. Oh, that I had one to hear me. Here's my signature. Let the Almighty answer me. Oh, that I had the indictment written by my adversary. Surely I would carry it on my shoulder. I would bind it on me as a crown. I would give him an account of all my steps. Like a prince, I would approach him. This is almost humorous, isn't it? To hear Job talk about how he's going to talk to God. Oh, that I had someone to hear me. I signed on. This is the NIV. I'm not going to read all that. We don't have time for it. Look at the bottom paragraph there. However, instead of placing God on the witness stand for the purpose of cross-examination or causing God to listen to his defense, Job was himself called to answer, and not concerning his righteousness, but concerning his understanding of God's actions in the natural world and his power to do what God did. Does God say to Job, I'm punishing you because... Well, in the first place, he's not punishing him. You're suffering because... No. Nothing in the first speech, at least. God doesn't answer that question. That's the question Job wants answered. Why am I suffering? What did I do? And God doesn't answer that question. Wow. Did God not know what question Job was answering, was asking? Or does God have a higher purpose than just simply satisfying Job's sense of justice or his curiosity about why God's doing what he's doing? I think there's a higher purpose here. Let's continue. We're about to run out of time. Chapter 40. Let's go to 40 and verse 1 here. And the Lord said to Job, shall a fault finder contend with the Almighty? He who argues with God, let him answer it. Then Job answered the Lord and said, I've got some things to say to you. I want to present... No. He says, behold, I am of small account. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand on my mouth. I've spoken once and I will not answer twice, but I will proceed no further. Wow, that's amazing from a guy who's been wanting from the beginning of the speeches with the friends to get God down and argue his case before God. What has Job figured out? What's Job discovered? Yeah, he doesn't have a clue of the way God works or what God has done. And back to Daniel's point, God is showing Job, you're down here and I'm up here. And I'm not talking about geography. I'm not obligated to give you an explanation. You know, it's interesting in Romans 9, in the beginning of that three-chapter discussion of Israel's role in God's redemptive plan, chapter 9 basically says God made choices and God has the right to make choices because he's sovereign. He's the potter. You're the clay. And the clay has no right to say to the potter, why did you make me this way in this vessel or that vessel? God is God and you are man. And Job has gotten that. But there's another lesson coming. God's going to teach him by repetition. And we'll get to the second speech in the next lesson. Yeah, Jennifer, you, I think maybe we'll get the last comment here.
Didn't Job know that, though? He knew about the gap between him and God, but he didn't really know. God is the one that's showing him how far apart they really are. Because he said, if God answered, you know, asking questions, I couldn't answer one of them. Now,
yeah, and I think the same thing you're saying could also be applied to Job's concept of God's justice. He says at times, God's unjust. You know, he's covered the face of the justices. He's doing this to me. I haven't done anything wrong. But then out of the side of his mouth, he says, if I have a chance to talk to him, he will find me righteous. That's nothing more than saying God ultimately is just. He will make this right. So he's talking both sides. Just like I think you're right. He ultimately, in his heart of hearts, he knows God is above him. He's even said that, you know, who can stop him? You know, he wouldn't listen to me. But then other times he talks like, well, I want him to come down here and talk to me and you know, explain to me. We're talking about a man who is in the depths of suffering. I don't think we need to forget that. I think that makes a lot of difference as to how we think and even how we speak or act. There's some lessons here. We'll talk more about them in the next class. I know the second buzzer is already rung. I don't want to keep you. But this is practical. This is practical for us. Just a quick observation. When a child dies, people begin to question God. Why did God let this happen? Or some calamity takes place. Why did God allow that? Why did God do this to me? And sometimes people begin to question God's justice, God's holiness, His character. Well, the book of Job has something to say about that. And so we'll kind of finish that thought on Wednesday. Wednesday is lesson 12. And then next Sunday morning, we will have a review of the entire book of Job. I'm going to do a crossword puzzle. There'll be some quotes. Bone up on your friends and your Elihu, even God.